Good afternoon. The time is 1:32, and I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. We're in Belts, Room 105, the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful sunny capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Monday, February 23rd. It's the last Monday in February and the first Monday of the rest of your lives. Members present today are Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Merrick, Senator Yunt, and myself. Senator Bjorkman, we have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Dunbar is excused. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please turn off your cell phones and join me in extending a warm Senate Labor and Commerce welcome to our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Jude Augustine. We have four items on our agenda today. They are Senate Bill 89, Physician Assistant Scope of Practice, SGR 25, supporting the U.S.-Mexico Canada Agreement, Senate Bill 164, eliminating tax discounts, Senate Bill 233, Controlled Substance Advisory Committee. First up, Senate Bill 89. We heard this bill last year, and after adopting a committee substitute, the bill moved from committee. Since that time, a compromise, we like those, has been reached between physicians and physicians' assistants, resulting in a new committee substitute that will be before the committee today. Today, I'd like to hear a recap of the bill from the bill sponsor. Thank you for joining us at the table already. Consider a new committee substitute which aligns statutes with stakeholder agreements, and then look to the will of the committee. With us for a recap of the bill and to explain work done over the interim, we have the Honorable Senator Lukey Tobin. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Lukey Gail Tobin, Senator for District I.
Mackenzie Pope, staff to Senator Lukey Gail Tobin.
Well, thank you again, Mr. Chairman. We know this bill has had a bit of a journey, and it is back before you today. For just a quick recap about what the legislation before you attempts to do, it is seeking to reduce the significant administrative burden on physician assistants to allow them to work to the maximum scope of their licensure. The CS that you will be considering today signifies a significant forward progress between stakeholders. And while the approach may have changed, the intent of the legislation remains the same. There have been some structural changes made to Section 2 of the bill, which we will walk you through here very shortly. But I want you to know that this section works to ameliorate concerns from some of our stakeholders and also Alaskanize our approach to ensuring physician assistants are able to continue providing exemplary care without undue burden and prohibitive administrative cost to practice. Now, if it's at your purview, Mr. Chairman, we are happy to go through a brief statement of changes or even an updated sexual analysis if you would like, and we are also available for any questions.
Thank you very much, Senator Tobin. If you all could please explain what has changed in the bill from last spring until now and then provide some rationale as to why those changes were made, that would be most excellent.
For the record, Mackenzie Pope, staff to Senator Lukey Gail Tobin. I'll be providing a brief summary of changes, and then we can speak a little bit to the narrative. So in the work draft version W that was provided to the committee, Section 2 has changed from version O to version W, and the section is removed. That begins on page 1, line 14, right at the bottom of the page, and it goes through page 4, line 10. In the hopefully soon-to-be-adopted version W, section 2 is replaced with an updated section that inserts language relating to the location of physician assistant practice and the collaborative agreement requirements. Version W will allow physician assistants to practice without a collaborative agreement when practicing within specific allowable facilities, and I can go through that full list if the committee would like. And version W maintains the collaborative agreement for physicians assistants, the existing collaborative agreement structure for physician assistants not operating within those allowable facility locations.
And for the record, Lukey Tobin, Senate District I. So after much discussion with stakeholders, we realized that the approach we were taking was not one that really resonated with the medical community. After quite a bit of work during this interim, we found that the legislation that we were considering took a national approach. What we realized is that to best meet the needs of Alaskan medical providers and the Alaskan community, that we needed to really Alaskanize what we were doing. So this led to significant discussions and collaboration amongst a core group of stakeholders in which they took a specific look at that Section 2 of the legislation, which does start on page 1, line 14, and realized that as we were discussing hours and ways to attest for those hours and different agreements and opportunities for appeal of when an agreement between a physician and their collaborating physician assistant did not find alignment, was really not actually answering the true intent of what we were trying to accomplish, which is to remove that administrative burden on physician assistants to their practicing. As we had heard in testimony prior to this hearing, there were some physician assistants who were having to pay upwards of $50,000 for a collaborating agreement. And we did not want to continue on that particular pathway of trying to ameliorate the concerns and to remove that collaborative agreement without actually having some solidified language that would allow for continued practice of independence. So the stakeholders came up with an approach that we think is really powerful. The core of what that approach is on page 3, starting on line 24, where it talks about if a physician assistant is working in a space without a collaborative agreement. And there you will see that the physician assistant who practices at a facility directed by a licensed physician, osteopath, or podiatrist, or at a facility licensed by the Department of Health, or at a facility that is under operated by the federal government or a tribal organization identified by U.S. code, or at a federally qualified health clinic in a rural community, or a military veterans facility, or a facility that is approved by the state board, the state medical board, they will be able to practice without a collaborating agreement. That is because, as we've talked many times before, medical care provided by a physician assistant is in an integrative approach. They often work with a very large medical community to provide quality care, particularly in the primary care realm. So this legislation really sought to recognize that that is where many of our providers who are physician assistants operate and provide care. And this was to the language that we included in this particular approach really recognizes that. Now, there are a handful of PAs who do provide care at a facility that's not listed in those, not listed under the sections on pages 3 and 4. And those particular physician assistants will need to maintain their collaborating agreement. We recognize that that is not necessarily the holistic view that the PAs were seeking, but it is a compromise and a step forward in removing the significant administrative burden that many of them were experiencing. So, Mr. Chairman, that hopefully provides a little bit of understanding of how we came to this particular approach. We think it is one that really recognizes the unique place that we are in as a state and also provides the pathway to remove that administrative burden that many PAs were experiencing that were preventing them from providing care within our communities.
Thank you, Senator. I think that is a good rationale as to why we should put the CS before the committee. May I have a motion, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 89, version 34-Lima Sierra 0063 / whiskey as the working document.
I'll object for purposes of further explanation. Senator Tobin, a question then. As we looked at this bill, there was significant discussion between stakeholders about hours that PAs would have to spend under a collaborative agreement before they are kind of released into the wild to practice on their own. What solution did the stakeholders come up with for this CS?
For the record, Lukey Tobin, Senate District I. One of the things we recognize is that there's very few PAs who do practice care outside of a licensed DOH, Department of Health facility, and that the idea was that in that collaborative space, the physicians and the folks who were really having significant reservations about providing independent licensure outside of a physician-led facility really didn't know or understand how someone would be able to meet their high expectations. In our conversations with stakeholders, we realized there was very few physician assistants that were going to be leaving a facility licensed by the Department of Health. They would always be providing care within that collaborative, integrative approach. And that the recognition of some level of hours to then provide independent licensure wasn't actually the intent of where physician assistants were aiming to end up. They were still going to continue to provide care within that collaborative approach. So in our discussions, we realized that that actually wasn't the goal, or that wasn't really the intent of what we were trying to accomplish, which is independent licensure through an hours or a benchmark of what folks were trying to accomplish. Instead, it was really about removing the administrative burden, the cost that was being held by PAs to find that collaborating physician. So that is what the bill before you seeks to do, is remove the heavy burden and allow PAs to work within those facilities, which they will continue to work at without having to pay for a collaborating agreement.
Understood. Thank you for that. If a PA has their own shop, let's say they have their own building, their own office, or they rent a space in a larger building, but there is not an MD or another professional that would meet the standard needed for a collaborative agreement replacement, what happens to them? What happens to them if they're just on their own as a PA or a group of two PAs and there's not a doctor who works with them?
For the record, Lucy Tobin, Senate District I. Unfortunately, we've seen this already happen here in Juneau. There was a physician assistant who owned a practice but lost their collaborating physician and the facility had to close. Unfortunately, in the example that you provide, if the physician assistant who is operating or providing care at a facility that's not licensed under DOH and is not in that integrative approach and is unable to maintain a relationship with a collaborating physician, their facility would no longer be able to provide care.
Okay, let me rephrase my question. So my understanding is that a PA or a group of PAs who have their own facility, they likely would not qualify as a DOH licensed facility unless what? That's my first question. How what constitutes a DOH licensed facility or not? Secondly, could they not still identify with a collaborating physician anywhere and work with them? Would there be a barrier to them getting a collaborative agreement? And then third, how many hours do they need to practice under a collaborating agreement in order to practice on their own?
For the record, Mackenzie Pope, staff to Senator Lukey Gail Tobin. In that instance, these PAs would still be within the collaborative agreement structure that is maintained today, and the hours discussion that was proposed in previous iterations of this bill is no longer pertinent. So the PAs would, in that instance, operate under a collaborative agreement indefinitely, and any barriers that they would have to finding a collaborating physician are all the barriers that PAs are currently experiencing. And so this shrinks the pool of PAs looking for collaborating physician signatures significantly and relies on the patient safety mechanisms and oversight mechanisms that come from the list of facilities that have oversight and safety procedures nested within them. DOH licensed facilities is just one of the five enumerated facility types. So the types of facilities that are still directed by a physician are licensed by DOH, licensed by the federal government or operated by a tribal organization, a federally qualified health center or rural health clinic, and a military and veterans facility. All of those locations, those PAs won't need to operate with a collaborating agreement. And so hopefully that will add some flexibility to the market of looking for a collaborating physician signature. And if those, two or three PAs that own a facility think that they should be considered to not have, say they have all been operating for 10 years, that is kind of the case that we were alluding towards with having the stipulation that the board can consider an application from a PA or a group of PAs if they believe that they should be considered eligible for operating without a collaborative agreement.
Very good. Does anyone else have questions? I have a couple more questions. Many providers are concerned that some kind of health center, hospitals or others who have kind of primary care physicians that work at them would be encouraged under legislation like this to simply hire PAs at a lower cost to them rather than hire MDs. Can you tell the committee and the public a little bit about that concern and whether you feel that policy choices in this bill would make it easier for a health center to just hire PAs and have a collaborating physician one or someone outside of that facility if they're qualified? Could they just hire PAs and not hire any MDs at all?
For the record, Lukey Tobin, Senate District I. Unfortunately, I don't have a crystal ball, and I can't really tell you what folks within the medical community will and will not do. But what I can point out is nurse practitioners currently have no requirement for a collaborating agreement with providers, and many healthcare facilities have the ability to hire those folks at whatever rate that they currently require or ask for. This bill simply puts physician assistants on par with the ability to be able to be hired without having significant additional administrative burden, which is that cost of the collaborating agreement. I do know that, and we've heard from many providers, that integrated approach is really key to providing quality primary care, and that's why we really talk about physician-led facilities, that the healthcare facilities that are provided here in the state that are licensed under the Department of Health and also have been discussed here on pages 3 and 4 really do focus on the idea that it is a team approach, that they're looking for a collaboration. In some cases, there's a doctor who does provide certain levels of care, and they also recognize that the physician assistant can continue to provide quality care for some of those lesser acute issues or some of the issues that are chronic.
And for the record, Mackenzie Pope, staff to Senator Tobin, we're also hearing from a number of providers and of these facility operators. MDs have unparalleled education in the healthcare space. We are also struggling to hire MDs into the state, and advanced practice providers like physician assistants are filling gaps in care. And this seeks to keep these providers who have provide really really good medical care to their patients. It's not necessarily competing with MDs, but there aren't enough MDs to fill all the need that we have in the state.
Understood. Okay, last question. The DOH licensed facilities and PAs that work in them, is there a requirement for an MD to work on site at the same time while PAs practice? What requirement is there existing for an MD to be present at the same time? If we're talking about like physician-led practice, like what expectation should a patient have if they're going to see a PA at a facility? Will there be an MD around, or can that MD be not around? Can they be in Colorado or Florida? What's the expectation there according to this bill?
For the record, Lukey Tobin, Senate District I. Currently in statute, there is no expectation at any DOH facility to have any particular type of provider available upon request of the patient. That is really something that is the relationship between the individual client and the provider that they seek to get care at. DOH licensed facilities are primarily our hospitals, our medical clinics, those types of practices. There's a very different dynamic than maybe a private-owned facility that we have listed under page 3, line 26, where it says a facility directed by a licensed physician. Those could be private practice. So again, a different type of facility in relationship to the state, and also the idea that consumers and clients are going to pick the facility that best meets their needs.
Understood. Any further discussion? Okay, with that, I withdraw my objection to adoption of the CS. Is there any further objection? Hearing and seeing none, CS for Senate Bill 89, Labor and Commerce version LS0063/W is adopted. Very well. That brings the underlying bill back before the committee. Are there any final questions or discussion for the committee or questions for Sylvan Robb or others about this bill? Hearing and seeing no further objections, discussion, or comments, may I have a motion, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move to report committee substitute for Senate Bill 89, version 34-Lima Sierra 0063/Whiskey from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing no objection, committee substitute for Senate Bill 89, version 34-LS0063/W, as in wrangle, is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill.
Thank you.
We're back on the record now here in Belt's Room 105. Next up is Senate Joint Resolution 25. With us to present this resolution, we have Honorable Senator Scott Kawasaki and his staff, Samuel Marquardt. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce, gentlemen. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Merrick, and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. I'm Scott Kawasaki, Senator for District P, representing Fairbanks, Fort Wainwright, and Badger.
I'm Samuel Marquardt, staff to Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you for accepting this Senate Joint Resolution 25 so quickly in the session. SJR 25 expresses support and continuation for the modernization of the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA, which encourages reduction of trade barriers on the North American continent. My staff will tell you a little bit more about some of the details, but really why we wanted to bring this forward is the strong Alaska-Canada relationships that we have. This USMCA passed the House in 2019 with 385 representatives in support, only 41 against. It also was approved by the Senate later by a vote of 89 to 10 and was signed into law as a signatory act by President Trump in 2020. This is the scheduled review date in 2026. So this would represent an opportunity to preserve the basic economic benefits to participating countries of Mexico and Canada and the United States while pursuing targeted modernization and removal of further obstacles to continued cooperation. Predictable trade policy is essential to secure investment and sustained economic growth. Supporting the continuation and modernization of the USMCA promotes economic stability, protects jobs, that's Alaskan jobs, and strengthens long-term growth across the state and North America, and this resolution would show the support of the Alaska legislature. And so I will now pass it along to Mr. Marquardt for more details.
For the record, Samuel Marquardt, staff to Senator Kawasaki. So the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement is a 2020 bipartisan trade agreement that enables free, predictable, and profitable trade across North America. As mentioned in our sponsor statement, bipartisan to support, initially introduced in President Trump's first term, and has been hugely successful for all participating countries and the state of Alaska. And the reason we bring it to you today is that this is its year of review. This only happens every 6 years, and given the rapid pace of trade developments and technological developments, I think it's important that we take this opportunity and not pass on it, given it won't happen for another 6 years. SCR 25 supports the continuation and modernization of USMCA and removes some unnecessary barriers to its efficacy. It's specifically beneficial to Alaska. Canada is Alaska's closest trading partner and the only one with which it shares a land border. So that provides two important benefits. First, supply line efficiency. The only land border, again, is Canada. So we receive a lot of our goods and materials across that border. So preserving our relationship with Canada and ensuring efficient trade is really important. There's also non-trade related benefits. Obviously, recent barriers to trade have stressed our relationship with Canada, and continuing USMCA and removing some of those barriers will help to alleviate those and continue the benefits that we receive having a positive relationship with Canada. Things like mutual tourism, defense partnerships, all of these are really important reasons why maintaining a stable relationship with Canada is really important. The stability provided by USMCA is also key to securing Alaska's economic future. The first is investment opportunities. Obviously, investors need consistency. They need predictability, and USMCA provides that. If we are trying to create a new trade agreement every 5-6 years, we'll never have the stability key to long-term investment. Alaska's businesses also benefit. We get cheaper goods, and our suppliers are provided with the resources they need to create goods in Alaska when we have efficient, predictable trade agreements like USMCA. And with that, I'll ask for any questions.
Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your presentation. But just for so that I can understand, because the agreement is United States-Mexico-Canada agreement. So how does Mexico fit in this agreement? Because I keep hearing just Canada. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I'll just say that the USMCA is designed for the entire North American continent, and so that is including Canada and Mexico. We were just promoting particularly the Canadian aspect because, of course, we share a great land border. I think they're our number one trading partner by volume. Between here and the United States, we have to drive to Canada to get to our legislative session, and so I think there's a definite relationship, not to dismiss the relationship that Alaskans might also have with Mexico, but definitely the USMCA impacts Alaska disproportionately.
Yeah, through the chair to Senator Gray Jackson, that's correct. We do trade with Mexico, just not nearly as much as Canada, so we chose to emphasize our positive relationship with Canada.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for the question, Senator Merrick. Actually, I'm wearing blue and gold today because this is the color one wears when the UAF Nanooks clobber the UAA Seawolves and retain the Governor's Cup. And so that's why I decided to wear this. And thank you once again for the question.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Kawasaki, can you tell me if there are any concerns with Canada not wanting to trade with us because we beat them in the U.S. men's hockey game yesterday?
Boy, I would just have to say, not speaking on behalf of Canada, but speaking on behalf of the United States, they sure did take a whooping. But, of course, they are an ally, and we definitely will share a beer or two with our allies at any point in a juncture like this.
Thank you.
Thank you both. As we think about diplomacy with our neighbors, certainly serious situations arise, which like have happened over the weekend. in Jalisco and other parts of Mexico surrounding Puerto Vallarta. I'm wondering, as we kind of think about a pretty dynamic state of change that could happen rapidly over this week and the next, how this legislation might reflect that many Alaskans, like dozens if not more than 100, are kind of trapped inside of whatever shelter they can find right now in Mexico, and how might this legislation seek to accommodate that, or would you like it to not mention those types of things? My question is, as we kind of wade into international relations and politics like this, it's really super dynamic, right? And so would you be interested in making comments on that inside of this resolution?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman Scott Kawasaki, for the record, I'd prefer not. I think that trade is one of those things that folks can value outside of other relational activities that are happening. I will also say that, you know, since we're talking so broadly about Canada, that the 11th Airborne Division and Canada do great work together. And some of us were up in Fairbanks, including Senator Rob Myers, to just see the kinds of operations with our Canadian partners. They have a two-star general that's actually duly deputized within the 11th Airborne Division within the state of Alaska on behalf of the federal government, on behalf of the national government and the United States Army. And so it is, there are things like that where we have relationships. We beat them in hockey, and we also partner with them when it comes to our military affairs and our trade. And so I don't know that we want to talk about all the negatives, but we certainly want to talk and highlight the positives.
Very good. Thank you. As we know, over the past week, the Supreme Court made a rather substantial decision specifically around tariffs. In response to that, the president signaled that he would again unilaterally change tariffs. And from reading Justice Kavanaugh's opinion about that case, it sounds like there may be a path for him to do that. Have you considered those instances and how we might tailor this resolution further, or is it just we're going to ask them to repeal all of the tariffs still?
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. I don't know that I've got any, you know, any particular preference about things that we can object to or promote within this particular USMCA. The USMCA was obviously clearly a sort of opportunity for us to encourage those trade barriers reductions, the reductions in the trade barriers, which is sort of contrary to the entire sort of fights we might have with tariffs, which just end up costing consumers on both ends. I think the USMCA, again, this was an initiative through the Trump administration and through his first term in office that really brought this together and largely brought this together with a very compliant Congress, again, passing 385-41. This free trade helps both parties and helps us here in North America, and particularly, once again, as stated in the Senate Joint Resolution 25, helps us because as a state, we're so inextricably linked to Canada.
Very good. Well, with all that lively discussion and even talk of sports, maybe we've given something for your invited testifier to further add to his account in support of SJR 25. So we'll go now to your invited testifier, Senator Kawasaki. Mr. Myers, can you hear us?
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record and through the chair, my name is Stephen Myers. I serve as Director of Program Management at the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, also known as PENWAR. And for background, our organization is a statutory nonprofit public-private partnership that includes the five U.S. states of Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington, and the five Canadian provinces and territories of Alberta, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Northwest Territories, and Yukon. And Alaska has been a core member of PENWAR since its founding in 1991, And as part of our organization, we promote cross-border trade and collaboration with all our member jurisdictions, and it's a key component of the mission that we have at FinWarn. And today I'm here to speak in favor of review of this Senate Joint Resolution 25 supporting USMCA. I think it's already been highlighted, but the renegotiation of NAFTA and today's USMCA is a significant accomplishment for President Trump's first term. And it's been also stressed about the bipartisan support it had in Congress. But since 2020, we've seen a huge increase from Canada and Mexico when it comes to trade with the U.S. It's increased by 56%, which is approximately about $343 billion in investment from Canada. We see the USMCA as an operating framework that promotes how Alaska works with all our jurisdictions in the North American economy, and that it's strong, and that we strongly support the resolution today to reaffirm Alaska's support for USMCA, urging a 16-year continuation. In particular, you know, Alaska depends on the movement of goods through Canada. It's been stressed about that. In particular, we see construction materials, energy inputs, fuel, machinery, and consumer goods all rely on predictable cross-border access. And when the trade rules are stable, we see those costs remaining manageable. In 2024, we saw Alaska imported more than $1 billion in goods from Canada, and that's all essential to Alaska's economy. And that same year, Alaska exported more than $600 million to Canada. And they just show how integrated our supply chains are. I was going to highlight, too, just the impact that USMCA has on employment in Alaska. Canadian support, more than 20,000 Alaska jobs, nearly 6,000 additional jobs provided by Canadian-owned businesses operating in the state. So that's why when the joint review comes up on July 1st, we see it as a critical time for the state, especially with energy projects, critical mineral development, transportation infrastructure, Arctic logistics. All those sectors rely on planning for decades out. And so these types of predictable trade rules give investors and operators the confidence to commit to long-term capital needed for these projects. So this is kind of wrap things up here and just reiterate the important role that Canada has as well with Alaska on defense, Arctic partnerships, just having that stable relationship. You know, strengthening cooperation on national security, emergency response, and infrastructure, while supporting Alaska's tourism industry as well. So there's a lot of integrated connections that Alaska has with Canada, and we really just want to stress that important structure that USMCA provides and the stability that having that continuation of the 16 years would provide. But without that, we would see a renegotiation of it or just every year they'd have to go through a process, and then if there was ever a withdrawal from it, that would take Congress to do it, and so there'd be more insecurity and just not a lot of clarity on where things would go. And so our hope is to see that the USMCA moves forward, and that's really what we wanted to stress today, and happy to answer any questions that anybody has.
Thank you very much, Mr. Myers. Are there any questions for Mr. Myers? Hearing and seeing none. Senator Kawasaki, do you have any closing comments for today?
I just wanted to once again thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Vice Chair Merrick, and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee for speedily hearing Senate Joint Resolution 25. I look forward to future working with you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Hearing no further questions, comments, or committee discussion on SJR 25, we will set the resolution aside for further consideration at a future meeting. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. We're back on the record. It's 2:14 here in Belts, Room 105, and the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee has resumed. Next up is Senate Bill 164. To present this bill, we have the Honorable Senator Kelly Merrick and her staff, Ms. Hazleton. Ladies, thank you for joining us. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation of the bill.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Bjorkman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, I'm Kelly Merrick, Senator for District L in beautiful Chugiak Eagle River, and thank you for hearing Senate Bill 164 today. Mr. Chairman, I think you would agree that the best things in life come in small packages. That's why my staff has dubbed Senate Bill 164 Little Baby Tax Changes. If a simple tax bill exists, this is it. Senate Bill 164 was drafted last year when it seemed like the whole country was focused on government efficiencies. Mr. Chair, our constituents want a more streamlined, cost-effective government, and this is a small step in that direction. Our nonpartisan Legislative Finance Division, in cooperation with the Department of Revenue, published the Indirect Expenditure Report every other year. If you're new to the Indirect Expenditure Report, this riveting document is hundreds of pages analyzing areas where we may be foregoing revenue and whether or not that's what we want. Our intention with Senate Bill 164 is to take several, we hope, non-controversial recommendations from Legislative Finance, reassess them, and begin the conversation as to whether they still serve a purpose or if we need these drops in our revenue bucket instead. The Department of Revenue estimates that SB 164 could raise nearly $500,000 a year for the state. This money could be included in a capital budget, fund sexual assault examination kits, training for BPSOs, trooper housing, or DPS vehicle repairs. Mr. Chairman, my staff can walk through the selections we've made for this bill, but at the end of the day, this is a simple tax bill, just asking the question, do we want to do what we're doing? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Merrick. Are there any questions from committee members for Senator Merrick or her staff? Hearing and seeing no questions, we have two people online for questions, Mr. Dan Sickle and Connor Bell. Are there any questions for either of those gentlemen? I have a question. Either Mr. Stickle or Mr. Bell might be able to answer. Could you please walk us through more about what the indirect expenditure report is and how legislative finance uses that tool to communicate about potential policy changes to the legislature?
Sure. This is Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. I can probably take a first stab at that, and then Connor might have some information to add. So there's a statutory requirement that Department of Revenue publish an indirect expenditure report every 2 years, and that we are looking for anything that is an express provision of state law that results in foregone state revenue. And so our job in the Department of Revenue is simply to coordinate the compilation of that information across all state agencies and then publish that report. We do not, in Department of Revenue, make an official policy statement about any of those expenditures. We just compile the information. And we do that in Department of Revenue because a lot of the indirect expenditures are tax credits and allowances and such that are located within the department. And then that in turn gets published on our website by July 1st of every even numbered year. And then Legislative Finance in turn publishes a report where they do make formal recommendations on what to do with the various expenditures.
Mr. Bell.
For the record, Connor Bell, Fiscal Analyst with Legislative Finance Division. Yes, following up on what Mr. Stickle said, Legislative Finance takes the compiled information from Department of Revenue and reviews the information on a rotating basis. So this most recent year, there were no agencies. For the next report, there will be several agencies, including Department of Revenue. But we review these expenditures to make a recommendation. It puts legislative finance in an uncomfortable position of making policy recommendations when we're a nonpartisan agency, but we're called in statute to make these recommendations on the indirect expenditure report. And when possible, we defer to the principle of whether the indirect expenditure is meeting legislative intent, whether it appears to be the intent of the legislation that was enacted to make this, to forego this revenue.
Very good. Thank you. Are there further questions for Mr. Stickle or Mr. Bell? Hearing and seeing none, Ms. Hazleton, if you could walk us through an explanation of the sectional and maybe some rationale as to why you all chose to include these changes in this bill, that would be most excellent. Thank you.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sorcia Hazleton, staff to Senator Merrick. As the Senator mentioned, this bill comes from the indirect expenditure report, specifically from 2021. You all received hard copies, and a digital copy is available. As both DOR and Legislative Finance mentioned, they look at them program by program and department to figure out where the state has said it would like to forego revenue and make the recommendation whether or not those programs are maybe still in use or meeting those expectations. There are more recent reports, but they don't cover all of the same programs because they do not look at the whole state every single year. We looked through the report and pulled a few of the pieces where LegFi has recommended legislative review. These specific items are included as separate backup documents in your packet with the page numbers from the report, as well as the more updated versions from the Department of Revenue, though theirs does not include recommendations. The sectional summarizes the specific deductions and credits SB 164 is eliminating, the motor fuel tax timely filing credit, the tobacco products tax timely filing deduction, the cigarette stamp tax discount, and the tire fee timely filing discount. These were selected based on a combination of the legislative finance recommendation, the possible ease of a consensus among legislators, and I'm happy to go section by section with more detail if you'd like.
Yes, please. I think that would be helpful.
Section number one of SB 164 eliminates the timely filing credit for motor fuel taxes. This tax was enacted in 1951 and last amended in either 1997 or 2015 to encourage remitting these taxes to the state in a timely manner. Not all types of businesses who remit taxes have a similar credit, so removing it would level some of the playing field. LegFi recommended terminating this discount and considering a penalty for the late filing instead. SB 164 removes the discount, recovering an estimated $68,000 annually. Section number two eliminates the Tobacco Products Tax Commission deduction. Instituted in 1988 and last amended in 1997, this discount was intended to cover the expenses of accounting for and remitting the tobacco taxes to the state. Not all types of businesses who remit taxes have similar deductions, and online tax payments have significantly simplified this process. Legislative Finance recommended termination, stating that the reduction may be obsolete with those technological advances. This section will recover an estimated $52,000 annually. Sections 3 and 4 eliminate the cigarette stamp tax discount. In 2003, the legislature included this discount to defray the costs of purchasing the new equipment required for stamping cigarettes. At the time, the machine cost $75,000, and the discount was up to $50,000. These stamps are affixed to acknowledge that taxes have been paid on the cigarettes, and today the machines have been purchased and the stamping is largely done out of state. LegFi recommended termination, as the stamps should be considered a cost of doing business when selling cigarettes in the state of Alaska. These sections would recover roughly $308,000 annually. Section 5 largely repeals the tire fee timely filing discount. Like other timely filing fees in this bill, not all taxpayers receive the discount, and this was recommended for termination. The tire fee remains and is not adjusted for inflation, which would roughly double it if we did. The section would recover roughly $38,000 annually. Section 6 is the effective date, which will need adjusting as the committee sees fit. In total, this bill recovers roughly $467,000, which is not a lot, but it's something. I'm happy to elaborate where I can. I'm happy to pass questions to those online or follow up with answers from members.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hazelton. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, do you have anything in wrap-up, Senator Merrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We just appreciate the committee's time for hearing Senate Bill 164 today.
Very well. Thank you. At this time, we will set Senate Bill 164 aside for further consideration at a future meeting, and we'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. We're back on the record. It's 2:26 now here in Senate Labor and Commerce. Our final item for today is Senate Bill 233. With us to present the bill, we have the Honorable Senator Matt Clayman and his staff, Ms. Carly Dennis. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation of the bill.
Thank you very much, members of the committee, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Matt Clayman. I represent Senate District H in West Anchorage. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 233. Senate Bill 233 places the Controlled Substance Advisory Committee, or the CSAC, under the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. The CSAC is charged with advising the governor of when to add, delete, or reschedule substances under Alaska law. They also evaluate the effectiveness of current programs, budget and appropriations, enforcement policies, and procedures, treatment, counseling, and regulations regarding controlled substances. The committee is currently administered by the Department of Law. The Department of Law has requested that the committee be reassigned because they are unable to prioritize it. The shorthand is they're good at getting trials ready, getting cases ready for trial. They're not good at getting committees organized. While the Department of Law sits on numerous boards and committees, the CSA is the only committee that the Criminal Division manages, and managing the committee is practically outside their purview. This fall, a constituent contacted our office urging us to schedule kratom as a controlled substance. Kratom is currently not listed as a controlled substance in Alaska, although the Drug Enforcement Administration has listed it as a chemical of concern. Working with that constituent, we learned that the CSAC had not been meeting regularly, and we requested that the Department of Law convene the committee to consider scheduling kratom. In December, the committee finally did meet and recommended that the active ingredients in kratom be scheduled as a Class 2A controlled substance. After the meeting was over, I had some conversations with the Department of Law, and they acknowledged that it would be better if this were in a department that did committees regularly. So I believe this committee offers an important public safety service, and it should be assigned to a department that is fully equipped to effectively staff it. I'm happy to answer questions, and I believe Deputy Attorney General Angie Kemp is online for invited testimony.
Excellent. Thank you, Senator Clayman. Are there any questions for Senator Clayman before we go to invited testimony? Hearing and seeing none, we do have Ms. Angie Kemp on the phone. Ms. Kemp, can you hear us?
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Angie Kemp, Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law, Criminal Division.
Thank you.
I'm certainly happy to... Oh, sorry, there's a little bit of a delay. Sorry about that.
Thank you for joining us today. Please begin your presentation of the bill.
Thank you, Chair. My understanding is from my role today, I intend on just answering questions and being available for questions. I can certainly talk about anything that as far as I'm familiar with, the committee, the work of the committee, and their role and our role as far as resources go. I'm certainly happy to answer questions on those issues.
Excellent. Ms. Kemp, do you feel like the Controlled Substance Advisory Committee is a good fit for the Department of Law, or do you agree with the good senator that it should be housed under Commerce, Community, and Economic Development?
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Chair. So certainly I think that from the criminal division's perspective and the role that we play, I'll just give you a little bit of an understanding of how we staff this committee. At present, a person who's primarily assigned to the committee is an attorney who works in our office of special prosecution. She, just as today, for example, was trying to facilitate getting another meeting scheduled for the pharmacy, doing that work, also reviewing unclassified felony cases, deciding whether what action we should take from that matter. I say that largely to point out it may be probably obvious that her primary work for the chief focusing the
Hey, Ms. Kemp, can I just stop you for just a quick minute? Sometimes if folks are on speakerphone, it's really hard to hear. So if you are on speakerphone, if you could not be on speakerphone, we could understand you a lot better. We're just having a hard time understanding you when you're talking to us.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm getting a little bit of feedback myself. I'm going to say something that's hilarious, Chair Yorkman. This is we have Teams calling here, and that's the only source of phone that I have that I'm calling from. I can call back in on my cell phone. I think I'm getting quite a bit of feedback.
Okay. I think we can hear you fine enough. It's just super difficult. But, yes, I am familiar with the changes of what you speak. made by the IT Borg that is existing inside of our state government that doesn't always function greatly. Please continue, and we'll try to muddle through here.
All right. My apology, Chair Bjorkman. And I will go a bit slower, hopefully, to help if folks can hear me that way a little bit better. What I was explaining is that this committee is currently primarily staff and the resources that go along with supporting it through our Office of Special Prosecution. We have an attorney who has a full caseload. She's also chiefly responsible for facilitating, for example, getting the meeting scheduled for the committee and its work. The example that I gave a moment ago is that when I talked to her today about her welfare, she was simultaneously screening an unclassified felony offense and trying to schedule with the Board of Pharmacy the next hearing for this committee. A few other things that may be worth considering, the criminal division is seriously. I'd argue a reactive entity. We are not on the front lines of emerging drugs. We're not as well-versed in some of the things that are the primary issues.
Ms. Kemp, I'm afraid we're going to have you call back in. It's unintelligible. I'm sorry. So if you could please.
No worries.
Yep.
Give me just 1 minute and I'll call back in.
Yep. Very well. We'll take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. It's 235 now in Belt's Room 105, Senate Labor and Commerce. It's currently considering Senate Bill 233. We left off, we were speaking with Ms. Angie Kemp from the Department of Law about whether or not it was still appropriate for the Controlled Substance Advisory Committee to remain under Department of Law, or if that committee should be transferred to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Ms. Kemp, welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce.
I'm so sorry for that, Chair Bjorkman. That I hope, maybe hilariously, I could have come across the street and was trying to give myself a bit of time here. I apologize for that. So once again, my name is Angie Kemp. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. And I will, with the likely scenario that I'm going to end up repeating myself and hopefully not wasting as much of your time as more than needed, I'll restate what I said a minute ago. So it was asked of me essentially and what it is, the relationship to the committee and how our resources at the Criminal Division were being used, or at least that's the question that I was answering. I will just again repeat for the committee, the Department of Law or Criminal Division currently takes care of this work using an attorney who's in our Office of Special Prosecutions. That person has a full caseload themselves. She, as when I was, the example that I gave, I called her today to ask her about the status of future meetings and when those might be scheduled. And when we were chatting, one of the things she mentioned to me was she was also screening an unclassified felony offense. I say that to illustrate perhaps the point that this attorney has a full caseload herself and is primarily focused on that caseload more than anything compared to, for example, the work of the committee. As far as I'm aware, we're never given resources or don't have resources to staff this committee. We're unfortunately also an agency that I would describe as more reactive than some. So as this committee is deciding where this responsibility should lie, thinking about things like the Criminal Division is largely, as I said, a reactive agency and may not be as best positioned compared to some agencies for this work. And for example, one of the obligations of the committee is to understand and be familiar with new drugs that are coming onto the market, the likelihood of addiction related to those substances, and the likelihood of abuse, for example. The Criminal Division, again, I think most folks understand this, but we're receiving our feedback primarily funneled through the law enforcement agencies. We're not on the front line dealing with some of these issues that I think, for example, pharmacists may be seeing and treating providers will be seeing. I guess I would be remiss to say that this is not a call that the Department of Law it makes on where the resources for this task fall. That's certainly within the province of the administration and also this legislature. But I can certainly answer any more questions about the role of the committee and the work that's been done lately.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kemp. Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your comments. But my question has to do with the fiscal note, because it looks like a brand new fiscal note. And I mean, it's not a lot of money, but still, the committee is right now within the Department of Law. And so my question is there a line item within the Department of Law currently to fund this committee? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson, that was a question that I don't have the answer to. I made some efforts to try and identify whether we were ever given resources for it. We don't have a fiscal note for on this bill, but I think if the question is were we previously provided which resources, the answer to that is I don't know as I sit here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. But I would like to know if there is funding, a line item funding within the department, because I would think that it would just transfer over to the new department that's going to be handling this committee. But thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Kemp, are you able to get back to the committee in response to that question?
Yes, Chair, I can absolutely do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Also online at one time, I don't know if she still is, but Casey Schroeder is online. Is she still available? Not available. Okay. Well, I'm sure she could be reached by email if the committee would like to ask Ms. Schroeder questions as well. Any other questions or comments for Senator Klayman or his staff today? Hearing and seeing none, Senator Klayman, do you have any wrap-up comments?
Just thank you very much for hearing the bill today.
Very well. Well, with that, we will set Senate Bill 233 aside for future consideration at a future meeting. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Wednesday of this week when we will take up three items: Senate Bill 16, Refuse Utility Regulations; Senate Bill 205, Peace Officers, Firefighters, Disability; and Senate Bill 150, Net Metering Program and Fund. Senate Bill 89 will be removed from Wednesday's agenda because we moved it out of committee today. As there is no further business to come before the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee at this time, we are adjourned at 2:42 p.m.